Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 and to our listeners as well on Radio Verulam in St Albans. In the show this week we have Cameron Stewart, an actor who performed his one-man show at the Edinburgh Fringe. Coming up later in the show.
Born in 1884, just at sort of towards the end of the Victorian period. So he was born a Victorian, became an Edwardian, ended his life in 1947, just after the Second World War.
Part one of an interview with Caroline Walker, great-niece of Eric Gill, who was a famous sculptor and a letterer, a creator of fonts, and MacDonald Gill, little remembered now but famous in his time. Caroline is writing a book about MacDonald to bring him out of the shadows and back into the public domain. We have a feature from Tony Gosling about Montague Summers, who lived here in Bristol. And as always, we have Treasure Island and The What's On Guide. I'm John Peters Coleman. I'd like to welcome the aforementioned Cameron Stewart to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
I've got your book in front of me, and I do love guests who come in with a published book in front of me, because it just makes me feel like, I don't know, somebody really important has come in.
I hesitate to say it's my book. It's mainly my grandpa, but I've put bits in.
Okay, explain a little bit about your grandfather and how you knew him, because you've published a book which is his diaries, which hence you say it's mostly his. Mm-hmm. Were you aware as a child when you were growing up?
Yes, I was.
Of his war leg?
What he did was he wrote a diary when he was in the First World War. He went over the top on the Somme, at Arras and at Passchendaele. He was the only officer of his intake to survive. And he wrote quick little entries, and there wasn't time or inclination to write more, because if he had written more and the diaries had fallen into German hands, it could have been dangerous. So he wrote little entries like February the 13th, cold and wet, February the 14th, wet and cold, and talked about certain actions and things, but didn't elaborate on them enormously. And then what he did was he kept all his correspondence and all his postcards. He sent them home and people kept them for him. And then 11 years later, in 1928, he sat down and he turned it into a memoir. So he expanded on the entries and said, this is a rather brief description of what happened. Here's what actually happened. Right. And then goes into detail. What he does, though, is he tells it with a, I think, mordant humour is probably the best word. It's very wry. And he says at one point, that summer of 1916, the flies were an absolute plague. Great, big, fat, sodden, overfed, bloated brutes, blue bottles and large houseflies. They must have come from and lived on dead bodies. I've seen them on the roof of a dugout like a swarm of bees. Then he says, the dugouts in this part of the line were also infested with rats, which would frequently walk over me when I was asleep. I never heard of them biting anyone, but they would lick the brilliantine from off my hair. So in the end, I had to give up using grease on my head altogether. So there's a whole kind of, you know, that he's got a sort of stiff upper lip, kind of wry way of telling it. But also he's very angry about the officers or the teetotal movement at home who tried to stop the troops having their rum rations and things. And it really, he gets quite exercised about that.
Okay. Well, were you aware of this when you were
growing up? Yeah. Sorry, that was
so everybody sort of was aware that he'd written these memoirs. And
well, he was my dad's father, but my mother said to me when I was about five and said I wanted to be an actor. Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, I said I saw Winston Churchill's funeral on the television. I said, Mummy, I want a funeral like that. That's my ambition. And then I said, but I think I'll be an actor first. And she said, well, you know, you won't get to enjoy that funeral, don't you? Anyway, she said, when you grow up and become a proper actor, you should do something with Grandpa's diaries. And I thought, yeah, but, you know, I just didn't know what. Mm. And then I sort of forgot about it. And then about 2007, early 2007, I think, my father handed them to me and said, you might like to have a look at these. And I had a proper look as an adult. And I was astonished by them. My
prejudice, I think, perhaps between the two world wars and the people entering into it, and I wonder what you've made of this, is that people entered into the First World War with a very naturally patriotic bent, but perhaps less so in the run-up to the Second World War, and then slowly we've become less and less naturally nationalistic or patriotic as the post-war years have gone by. I mean, what sort of an air did you get from the early entries, and how did that seem to sort of change towards the end?
Well, that's exactly what I talk about in my show, actually, the difference between being a man, being me, and growing up in the late 20th century and, well, have I grown up yet? Early 21st century. And being Grandpa's generation and my father's in the Second World War. And I think Yeah, they did. They went to war because they thought it was the right thing to do. They thought they were fighting to protect the poor little Belgian initially. And Grandpa came back from, he was working out in Malaya on rubber plantations, and his contract expired in early 1915. And he came back specifically to sign up, and did so, and joined the Cameronians. And by the 1st of July 1915, that's when he reported to train.
Okay. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your father. He also serves in a war.
My dad, he's...
Which is interesting, given that, you know, your grandfather really narrowly survived the first one.
Well, yeah. Grandpa tried to rejoin the Cameronians for the second one. He was 33 when he joined the First World War, so he was a bit older than the others. And then during the Second World War, in his 50s, he was deemed to be too old for the Cameronians, so he became ACAC liaison officer at Prestwick Airport up near Glasgow. My father went into the Navy, and I only discovered this week, I knew he was on MTBs, but I only discovered this weekend that he had also, he did North Atlantic and Arctic convoys as well.
Oh, my grandfather did that, Second World War.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah, well, I've just finished reading Max Hastings' book as an audio book. Well, actually, I'm finishing it tomorrow for BBC Audio. And that talks all about the Arctic. It talks about everything, but yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about how you divided up the diaries and tried to put them in some sort of order, or was it almost already done for you?
It was pretty much done for me, to be honest. I mean, yeah. I wouldn't claim to have done anything particularly astounding. I was helped initially by a friend who I told him about it, and he said we should do this as an ebook. And he'd been trying to do things as an
ebook. What did you think when he said the word ebook?
Well, I didn't really think anything much. I just thought, yeah, okay. The first people I'd approached with it were a radio company I used to do quite a lot of work for in London, and they said, I'm not sure I should really say this on the radio, but
okay.
They would only have been interested if he was gay, they said. They wanted some salacious detail, and I just said, oh, don't be so silly. And so anyway, it kind of, you know, followed its own logic anyway. And
so what additions did you put to it as a sort of a preface or suffix?
There's quite a lot I did. I've done an introduction explaining kind of how I found them and a bit about the family and things. And then I've also done an epilogue, an appendix, specifically about the things that he was talking about when he was on leave, and his wife and the family, and the sorts of... He went to the theatre a lot, because, of course, they didn't have telly or anything those days. You know, they actually went out. And also, a modern historian called Jonathan Boff has written 5 inserts, which are... They give the bigger picture, because, as my father said when he was on convoys, you didn't even know what was happening to boats the other side of the convoy. Grandpa didn't know why he was being sent where or anything. So the bigger picture, I'm not actually a historian, so Jonathan wrote in the bigger picture during that.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your one-man show. I mean, you published the book and then decided, was it your idea? I'm suddenly going to take the stage.
It just sort of happened, really. I published it as an e-book. I also recorded it as an audiobook, which I haven't actually put out there yet, but I will at some point, and played some excerpts on the Today programme on Radio 4, and then said where it was available. And people liked the excerpts, and lots of people bought it as an ebook, and then all sorts of publishers wanted to publish it, and also a theatre producer got in touch and said, you're an actor, you obviously read quite nicely, would you like to do it as a one-man show? And I always say yes to these things, so I did, and we took it to Edinburgh. It's called My Grandfather's Great War.
Yeah.
And it is, as I've kind of indicated, it's me talking about what it's like to be me, how I found the diaries, and I slip into Grandpa a bit, and then slowly, I don't want to give too much away, but you get drawn in to...
Have you filmed it? Or is there
on the website mygrandfathersgreatwar.co.uk, which is my producer's website for the show, there are some excerpts, kind of some clips of it, to give you a flavour. But I have to say, whenever you film anything that's done on stage, I always think it looks very odd, because stage acting is so different from film acting that whatever you do, it looks over the top.
It's best to see it in the flesh, as it were.
I think if you're going to see the show, I mean, I have no objection to turning it into a film at some point. But
got any plans to do any more throughout 2012?
I've got 2 booked in March at the moment. I've been taking a slight backseat on it for the last year or so, because I did it. It was exhausting me, to be honest. I do act out 2 battles single-handedly, and it's my aunt came to see. She said, we're coming to see your reading, Jamie. That's my other name, by the way. And I said, well, it's not really a reading. And she said, oh, what do you mean? And I said, well, and then she came to see it, and there's lots of big bangs, and, you know, it's, and it's a play. Okay. But just me in it, you know. But she said, oh, are all one-man shows like that? I said, I really don't know.
Okay. I really want to chat to you more, to be honest, but I mean, I thought my time is up, unfortunately. But the book is called A Very Unimportant Officer, Cameron Stewart. That is S-T-E-W-A-R-T Stewart, rather than the monarchical Stewart. CameronStewart.co.uk, and of course, if you just put My Grandfather's Great War into any search engine, then that will immediately come up. Thank you very, very much for coming in.
Pleasure. Thanks.
People who attempt to communicate with the dead are called mediums. But which of their messages from the dark side are real, and which are clever trickery designed to fill a gap where faith could be in the grieving and the credulous? Over the last century, one of the world's leading authorities on the subject, as well as acknowledged world expert on cannibalism and vampires, was one-time vicar of Bitton and resident of Clifton, the Reverend Montague Summers. He died just after World War II, but his writings about those who abandon God and open the forbidden doors to the other side on vampires and demonology live on. This week, Dialect's Tony Gosling retells some of Montague Summers' stories about those who dared to communicate with the dark side.
Although exorcism was not recognised by Protestants, there are instances upon record where an appeal has been made by English country folk for the ministrations of a Catholic priest. In April 1815, Father Edward Peach of the Midland District was implored to visit a young married woman named White of King's Norton in Worcestershire. She had for 2 months been afflicted with an extraordinary kind of illness which doctors could neither name nor cure. Her sister declared that a young man of bad repute, whose hand had been rejected, had sworn revenge and employed the assistance of a reputed wizard at Dudley to work some mischief. However that might be, the unhappy girl seemed to lie at death's door. She raved of being beset day and night by spirits who mocked and moped at her, threatening to carry her away, body and soul, and suggesting self-destruction as the only means to escape them. The clergyman of the parish visited and prayed with her, but no good resulted from all his endeavours. So it happened that a nurse who was called in was a Catholic, and horrified at the hideous ravings of the patient, she procured a little bottle of holy water, with which she sprinkled the room and bed. A few drops fell upon the sufferer, who uttered the most piercing cries and screamed out, "You have scalded me! You have scalded me!" The paroxysms, however, passed, and she fell for the first time during many weeks into a sound slumber. After some slight improvement for 8 and 40 hours, she was attacked by violent convulsions, and her relatives, in great alarm, on Tuesday in Rogation Week, the 2nd of May, 1815, sent a special message to beg Father Peach to come over immediately. When the priest appeared, the girl was being held down in bed by two women who were forced to put forth all their strength, and as soon as she saw him, he was a complete stranger to her. Nor could his sacred profession be recognised by his attire. So terrible were her struggles that her husband was bound to lend his aid also to master her writhing limbs. Presently she fell into a state of complete exhaustion, and Father Peach dismissed the rest of the company and was able to talk to her long and seriously. He seems to have been quite satisfied that it was a genuine case of diabolic possession. And his evidence, carefully expressed and marshalled with great moderation, leaves no reasonable doubt that this strange sickness owed no natural origin. In the course of conversation, it appeared that she had never been baptised. A simple instruction was given, and finding her in excellent disposition, Father Peach at once baptised her. During the administration of this sacrament, she trembled like a leaf, and as the water fell upon her, she winced pitifully, a spasm of agony distorting her countenance. She afterwards averred that it gave her as much pain as if boiling water had been poured upon her bare flesh. Immediately afterwards, there followed a truly remarkable change in her health and spirits. Her husband and sister were overjoyed, and thought it no less than a miracle. The next day, Father Peach visited her again, and noticed a rapid improvement. Save for a slight weakness, she seemed perfectly restored. And, says the good father, writing a 12-month later than the event from notes he had taken at the time, there was no return, nor the least lingering symptom of her terrible, distressing malady. In its issue of 11th of October 1925, the Sunday Express, under the heading Evil Spirit Haunts a Girl, devoted a prominent column to the record of some extraordinary happenings. The account commences, "Haunted for 12 months and more by a mischievous spirit called a poltergeist, driven almost to a state of distraction, threatened with a lunatic asylum, and then cured by the help of a band of spirit Indians, is the extraordinary experience of the 19-year-old Gwyneth Morley, who lives with her widowed mother at Keighley, and who is employed in the spinning mills of Messrs. Hay and Wright. These phenomena were communicated to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who informed Mr. Hewitt Mackenzie with the result that the girl was brought to London for psychic treatment. Mr. Mackenzie being honorary principal of the British College of Psychic Science, an institution which is advertised as the best equipped centre for the study of psychic science in Britain, and announces lectures on practical healing, public clairvoyance, a small exhibition of notable watercolours representing soul development or experience of the soul in ethereal conditions. The college is, I'm given to understand, a well-known centre for spiritistic seances. Gwyneth Morley worked in Mr. Mackenzie's family for 3 months as a housemaid under close observation and receiving psychic treatment. Day by day, the amazing manifestations of her tormenting spirit were noted down. In between the new and full moon, the disturbances were worse. Everything in the room in which Gwyneth happened to be would be thrown about and smashed. Tables were lifted and overturned, chairs smashed into pieces, bookcases upset, and heavy settees thrown over. In the kitchen of Holland Park, the preparation of meals when Gwyneth was about was a disconcerting affair. Bowls of water could be spilt and pats of butter thrown on the floor. Another occasion was when Gwyneth was in the kitchen. The housekeeper, who was preparing some grapefruit for breakfast, found that one half of the grapefruit had disappeared and could be found neither in the kitchen nor in the scullery. She got two bananas to take its place and laid them on the table beside her. Immediately, the missing grapefruit whizzed past her ear and fell before her, and the bananas had vanished. Some 10 minutes later, they were found on the scullery table. All this time, Gwyneth was being treated by psychic experts. Every week, the girl sat with Mr. and Mrs. Mackenzie and others. It was found she was easily hypnotised and that tables moved towards her in the circle. At other times during the cure, the poltergeist seemed to accept challenges. One night, after a particularly exciting day, Mrs. Barkle magnetised her head and quietened her, and Mrs. Mackenzie suggested she should go to bed, saying, "Nothing happens when you get into bed." Going up the stairs, a small table and metal vase crashed over, and a little later, a great noise of banging and tearing was heard in Gwyneth's room. When Mrs. Mackenzie went into the room, it looked as if a tornado had swept over it. After an active spell from June the 21st to the 25th, the spirit behaved itself until July the 1st, when the girl had a kind of fit. Suddenly, she fell off her chair with her hands clenched. They laid her on the bed, and she fell into another fit. She gripped her own throat powerfully. Since that evening, she has had no further attacks, nor have there been any disturbances. I've quoted this case at some length, owing to the prominence afforded it in popular and widely read newspapers of the time. That the facts are substantially true, I see no reason at all to doubt. It's an ordinary case of obsession, and will be easily recognised as such by those priests whose duty has required them to study these distressing phenomena. That the interpretation put upon some of the occurrences is utterly false, I'm very certain. Their clairvoyance is merely playing with fire. I might say with hellfire, by those who cannot understand what they are about, what forces they are thus blindly evoking. Professor Jay and the band of Indians, indeed all these workers on the other side, are nothing else than evil, or at the least gravely suspect intelligences masquerading as spirits of light and goodness. If indeed the girl's relieved from obsession, one cannot but suppose some ulterior motive lurks in the background. It's but part of a scheme organised for purposes of their own by dark and secret powers, ever alert to trick and trap credulous man. The girl, Gwyneth Morley, should have been exorcised by a trained and accredited exorcist. These amateurs know nothing, or even faintly realise the harm they may do or the dangers they encounter. A bold mind such as that of Guazzo might specify their attempts, well-meaning as they are, no doubt, in terms I do not care to use.
The thoughts there of one of Bristol's greatest experts in the occult, the Reverend Montague Summers, who was writing and publishing from his home in Clifton between the First and Second World Wars. And Summers would probably frown knowingly if he was still alive today to see today's strange decisions where employees can lose their job if they wear a cross or can be dismissed for offering to pray for someone. And that was read by Dialect's Tony Gosling. Our next feature is by Anthea Page, who's in London recently, to interview Caroline Walker. And she's writing a book about her great-uncle, MacDonald Gill, brother to Eric Gill. MacDonald Gill was an architect, letterer and map painter during the arts and crafts movement, and his colourful maps adorned the walls of the London Underground, providing entertainment and relief from the dreary surroundings.
Friends all called him Max, so I'm going to call him Max, okay? He was my grandfather's brother, big family. There were 13 of them, 11 of whom survived to adulthood. And Max was one of the eldest of the six boys. His older brother was Eric Gill, who some people might have heard of, and he became a sculptor and letterer and engraver. MacDonald Gill, born in 1884, just at sort of towards the end of the Victorian period. So he was born a Victorian, became an Edwardian, ended his life in 1947, just after the Second World War. So his life spanned an enormous period of change. He was trained as an architect and came to London. He also took lettering classes, got heavily into lettering as well as his architecture, but he also loved painting. He particularly did a lot of work in church painting, decoration of churches, so incorporating the lettering as well as very colourful imagery in lots of religious buildings and churches. He'd always, even as a young boy, been interested in map drawing, and he entered competitions and he used to win prizes. His friends used to barter maps for birds' eggs, so Max definitely profited already by his map making when he was about 12. Then he didn't do any map making for many years, and in 1908, when he left a firm of architects, he set up on his own and was commissioned particularly to do lettering and church painting. But he came to the attention of an architect who had become very well known at the arts and crafts period, who was Edwin Lutyens, who designed some fabulous arts and crafts houses around the country, particularly in Surrey. And Lutyens used to get all kind of artists and craftsmen to come and decorate the houses that he designed. He chose Max to design what was called a wind dial map. This was for an amazing palace-like house in Buckinghamshire called Nashdom. It was built for a Russian prince and his English princess, Princess Dolgoruki. She was actually English. Anyway, Lutyens asked Max to do a wind dial map. So the map dial was a painting on a mahogany board, and it was positioned above a fireplace. It was a map of the area where the house was, and it shows on it, you've got a little tiny building on it, which is Nashdom, and you've got all sorts of other places on it. You've got Maidenhead, the edge of Windsor, the little train line with tiny train running along the tracks. Beautifully lettered north, west, and south, the points of the compass, and lots of colour with woodland and so on. Behind the map was a series of rods, of gunmetal rods, which went up the chimney, and they attached to a weather vane on the chimney. And whenever the wind turned the weather vane, the gunmetal rods would carry the movement down the wind dial map, and it would turn an indicator on the map, so that from inside the house you could see which way the wind was blowing. Cunning idea. Anyway, the idea actually came from merchants' houses in Holland, which actually were very functional there because the merchants wanted to know when their ships were coming in or when it was a fair wind to sail. So they would have these maps inside their houses to let them know what was happening with the weather outside, so they would know when their merchant ships were coming in. So they actually performed a function in those days. The maps that Lutyens got Max to do were, of course, purely decorative.
Thank you. tell us about MacDonald Gill's connection with Lindisfarne Castle.
That also came about through Edwin Lutyens, who had been commissioned by someone called Edward Hudson to refurbish, to restore the castle, which was pretty much a ruin. Hudson was the owner of the magazine Country Life, and he became a patron, really, of Lutyens. Lutyens restored the house beautifully, although I understand it was always very drafty and cold. No one actually ever lived there, but it was used as a summer home. And Max was asked to do a wonderful map in the hallway, which shows the Spanish Armada and the British fleet facing each other in the seas around Lindisfarne, which it's the most spectacular map I think he ever did.
Was it painted on the wall or on a piece of paper and then mounted?
In fact, it's just been restored, so the colours are now stable and bright. Most of Max's wind dial mats were painted on mahogany panels, with the exception of one that was also done for Lutyens, which is at Howth Castle in Dublin, and that was painted directly onto wet plaster in fresco style. But Max started to become known as a map maker. He continued his other work, but he started doing other sorts of graphic work for advertisements in the printing industry. Printing at that time is very interesting because printing techniques were changing very rapidly and colour printing started to become much more common and cheaper with new processes, particularly lithographic processes. And he was commissioned for a number of printing graphics by someone called Gerard Mennell. Gerard Mennell knew everybody in the printing business. And when the London Underground was, the managership of London Underground was taken over in about 1913, someone called Frank Pick became publicity manager, and he commissioned Gerard Mennell to produce a poster map for the platforms, because at that time the platforms were pretty gloomy places, and he wanted to brighten up platforms and the stations so that they became more attractive places, that people could actually enjoy standing waiting for their train. Then Mennell, who'd already used Max many times, asked Max, obviously, because Max was a known map maker as well. So Max produced this incredible map called the Wonderground Map, which was very iconic for its time. It was published in early 1914, and it shows London in a rather cartoon way. It's got all the little stations, some of which, of course, don't exist now. It's peopled by lots of little cartoon figures, which have balloon speech bubbles, and they have puns and quirky little comments about London, about Max's own family, which is fun for me, because trying to interpret some of these little messages and also people is quite fascinating. The map was an instant hit. If you think back to, this is nearly 100 years ago, there was no television, no radio, there was no internet. How did publicity work? Big thing at that time, the cutting edge publicity, was posters. So here was this wonderful poster, and it received, just as the latest iPhone application does, it received enormous publicity. So in the weeks and days that followed publication, the newspapers were full of black and white pictures and enormous amounts of comment and review about the impact of this map.
Have you got a copy of this map?
I haven't got a copy of the original 1914 map, but it was reproduced some years later in a slightly smaller form. Frank Pick saw a great marketing opportunity, and he started to sell it as in a fold-up form. I have a slightly smaller version of that, which was published in 1924 to coincide with the Wembley exhibition of that year.
So does the original one exist anywhere, or has it been lost?
Lots of prints of it exist. I think originally 2,000 were printed, and then more of the fold-up version. The London Transport Museum has several copies, and I know one or two relatives who have original prints. Lucky them. Because they're very collectible now.
was Caroline Walker talking to Anthea Page about her great uncle, MacDonald Gill, and you can hear part two on next week's show. Malcolm Grieve now reads chapter 30, part one of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 6, Captain Silver. Chapter 30, On Parole. I was wakened. Indeed, we were all wakened, for I could see even the sentinel shake himself together from where he had fallen against the doorpost by a clear, hearty voice hailing us from the margin of the wood. "Rockhouse, ahoy!" it cried. "Here's the doctor." And the doctor it was. Although I was glad to hear the sound, yet my gladness was not without admixture. I remembered with confusion my insubordinate and stealthy conduct, and when I saw where it had brought me, among what companions, and surrounded by what dangers, I felt ashamed to look him in the face. He must have risen in the dark, for the day had hardly come, and when I ran to the loophole and looked out, I saw him standing, like silver once before, up to the mid-leg in creeping vapour.
"You, doctor! Top of the morning to you, sir!"
cried Silver, broad awake and beaming with good nature in a moment.
"Bright and early, to be sure. And it's the early bird, as the saying goes, that gets the rations. George, shake up your timbers, son, and help Dr. Livesey over the ship's side. All are doing well, your patience was. All well and merry."
So he pattered on, standing on the hilltop with his crutch under his elbow, and one hand on the log-house. Quite the old John, in voice, manner and expression.
"We've a little surprise for you too, sir,"
he continued.
"We've a little stranger here. A new boarder and lodger, sir, and looking fit and taut as a fiddle. Slept like a supercargo, he did, right alongside of John. Stem to stem we was. All night."
Dr. Livesey was by this time across the stockade and pretty near the cook, and I could hear the alteration in his voice as he said, "Not Jim?"
"The very same Jim as ever was,"
said Silver. The doctor stopped outright, although he did not speak, and it was some seconds before he seemed able to move on. "Well, well," he said at last, "duty first and pleasure afterwards. As you might have said yourself, Silver, let us overhaul these patients of yours." A moment afterwards, he had entered the blockhouse and with one grim nod to me proceeded with his work among the sick. He seemed under no apprehension, though he must have known that his life among these treacherous demons depended on a hair, and he rattled on to his patients as if he were paying an ordinary professional visit in a quiet English family. His manner, I suppose, reacted on the men, for they behaved to him as if nothing had occurred, as if he were still ship's doctor, and they still faithful hands before the mast. "You're doing well, my friend," he said to the fellow with the bandaged head, "and if ever any person had a close shave, it was you. Your head must be as hard as iron. Well, George, how goes it? You're a pretty colour, certainly. Why, your liver, man, is upside down. Did you take that medicine? Did he take that medicine, men?"
"Aye, aye, sir. He took it sure enough," returned Morgan.
"Because, you see, as I am mutineer's doctor, or prison doctor, as I prefer to call it," says Dr. Livesey in his pleasantest way, "I make it a point of honour not to lose a man for King George, God bless him. and the gallows. The rogues looked at each other, but swallowed the home thrust in silence.
Dick don't feel well, sir, said one.
Don't he? Replied the doctor.
Well, step up here, Dick, and let me see your tongue.
No, I should be surprised if he did. The man's tongue is fit to frighten the French.
Another fever.
Ah, there, said Morgan. That come to spiling Bibles.
That comed, as you called it, of being arrant asses, retorted the doctor, and not having sense enough to know honest air from poison and the dry land from a vile pestiferous slough. I think it most probable, though of course it's only an opinion, that you'll all have the deuce to pay before you get that malaria out of your systems. Camp in a bog, would you? Silver, I'm surprised at you. You're less of a fool than many take you all round. But you don't appear to me to have the rudiments of a notion of the rules of health. Well, he added after he had dosed them round, and they had taken his prescriptions with really laughable humility, more like charity schoolchildren than blood-guilty mutineers and pirates. Well, that's done for today. And now I should wish to have a talk with that boy, please. And he nodded his head in my direction, carelessly. George Merry was at the door, spitting and spluttering over some bad-tasted medicine. But at the first word of the doctor's proposal, he swung round with a deep flush and cried,
No!
And swore. Silver struck the barrel with his open hand.
Silence!
He roared and looked about him positively like a lion. Doctor, he went on in his usual tones, I was a-thinking of that. Knowing as how you had a fancy for the boy. We're all humbly grateful for your kindness, and as you see, puts faith in you, and takes the drugs down like that much grog. And I take it, I've found a way as'll suit all. Hawkins, will you give me your word of honour as a young gentleman? For a young gentleman you are, although poor born. Your word of honour not to slip your cable. I readily gave the pledge required. Then, Doctor, said Silver, you just step outside of that stockade, and once you're there, I'll bring the boy down on the inside, and I reckon you can yarn through the spars. Good day to you, sir, and all our duties to the Squire and Captain Smollett. The explosion of disapproval, which nothing but Silver's black looks had restrained, broke out immediately the doctor had left the house. Silver was roundly accused of playing double, of trying to make a separate peace for himself, of sacrificing the interests of his accomplices and victims, and in one word, of the identical exact thing he was doing. It seemed to me so obvious in this case that I could not imagine how he was to turn their anger. But he was twice the man they were, and his last night's victory had given him a huge preponderance on their minds. He called them all the fools and dolts you could imagine, said it was necessary I should talk to the doctor, fluttered the chart in their faces, asked them if they could afford to break the treaty the very day they were bound a-treasure hunting.
No, by thunder, he cried. It's us must break the treaty when the time comes. Until then, I'll gammon that doctor, if I have to oil his boots with brandy.
And he bade them all get the fire lit and stalked out upon his crutch with his hand on my shoulder, leaving them in a disarray, and silenced by his volubility rather than convinced.
Slow, lad, slow, he said. They might round upon us in a twinkle of an eye, if we were seen to hurry.
That was Chapter 30, Part 1 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. And the second half of that chapter will be next week. You are now going to hear a clip from a longer interview with Joan Rees. Joan is 88 and she lives in Bristol. She is the third cousin of Ivor Gurney and remembers his death in 1937. Joan will be giving the address at the film premiere of Seven and Some, an award-winning drama documentary about the life of First World War poet and composer Ivor Gurney. More details of that and a clip from the film in this week's extended What's On Guide.
is Joan Rees. I was born Joan Headley, and my grandmother was a Miss Gurney, hence I am related. Three removed, I'm a third cousin of Ivor Gurney. My recollections of Ivor Gurney are nil, because I was 14 when he died. I was staying with my grandparents. She had a message, and I said, "What's happened, Granny?" "Oh," she said, "it's terrible. We've heard Ivor's just died. It was Christmas Eve, 1937. And I said, "Who is Ivor?" "Well," she said, "Ivor is your third cousin. And he lived in Maysmore in Gloucestershire. And he was in a mental hospital and he died because he was a very sick man." And Grandma told me this, and I was 14 years old in 1937. Yes, she said, "When I was a girl, we all three boys played together. There was Ivor and his other cousins," and she said, "they're all dead now because all three of them were killed because of the First World War. Ivor died, and as I say, he was in France, where he should never have been," she said. "He was wounded once in the trenches. He wrote some of his poems and his music when the gunfire was going, and used to say, 'Run down, out the way, hide,' and then they'd come up again. Then he was shot, and he was sent back to England. He was wounded and they paired him, but in the meantime he was in and out of mental hospital, and then he was sent back again. It was amazing to us as a family that he even survived. When he came back to Gloucester, he was sent to mental hospital in Barnwood. And of course that was too close to his home, and when he was feeling better, he'd get out and run home again. And of course, the hospital never knew where he was, so eventually he was transferred down to Kent, and that is where he died. He couldn't run home from there.
That was Joan Rees talking about her cousin Ivor Gurney. Opening next week is the film The Iron Lady. Meryl Streep plays Margaret Thatcher in her early days as she struggles against ingrained Tory sexism in her rise to power. Starting with Thatcher as an elderly person, the film is a series of flashbacks with Jim Broadbent playing the role of Dennis Thatcher. Richard E. Grant is also playing Heseltine. Some reviews have called it a parody. One of the flashbacks shows Grocer Dad Alfred with his heroic Blitz spirit. The screenwriter for the film The Iron Lady is Abby Morgan, and it's directed by Phyllis Lloyd. Some films only gave the film 2 stars, unlike Coriolanus, which opens on the 25th of January and is directed by Ralph Fiennes. For you theatre buffs, the cast is awash with great actors, Vanessa Redgrave for one, for example. The handheld style of camera work in this particular film gives it the feel of a modern-day action thriller, and Fiennes goes out of his way not to stint on the battlefield brutality. Not a film for the squeamish, perhaps. John Logan's script sticks faithfully to the Shakespeare original, showing respect for the strength of the Bard's work, and it has a 15 certification. Opening on the 13th of January is Steven Spielberg's War Horse, originally a National Theatre production, and a real proper tearjerker, I'm told. It was written as a play from the children's novel by Michael Mapergo. The story centres around a thoroughbred horse that is bought cheap at market by a drunken yokel farmer and sold eventually to the British cavalry and ends up on the battlefield of the Somme in the First World War. Benedict Cumberbatch and Emily Watson star in this film, to name but a few. It's a stirring adventure on an epic scale and is a 12A certification. On to music now. If you like jazz, the Magnificent Seven will be playing proper Brazilian dance music at the Canteen Bristol on the 13th of January, so I look forward to a night of sinuous percussion and glittering brass for a hot rhythmic night's entertainment. Jelly Records are again hosting this year's Bristol Acoustic Music Festival on Friday the 13th to Sunday the 15th at St George's Hall off Park Street. The festival makes up 20 hours of live music, but will also be recorded for Bristol Community FM 93.2. Organiser Steve Parkhouse said, "This year it's more diverse than ever, from folk roots to reggae. There's a choir on Sunday too. There's one thing that unites the performers. They're all 100% local." To find out more information, log on to the St George's website, which you can find on the web fairly easily. A little further afield now, Terremoto, Cuban Jazz, performed by Ray Barreto and Chuco Valdez, will be appearing at the Bell in Bath on Saturday the 14th. Also in Bath, Leslie Howard, a Liszt pianist extraordinaire, will be performing two of Rachmaninoff's difficult and technically formidable sonatas in a single programme, no less. And that's on at the Holborn Museum, Bath, on Thursday the 19th of January. Check the museum website for the Holborn Museum if you want more details. In the arts world, Bath will be lighting up its streets as a spectacular end to the misery of dark winter evenings. Clockwork City by Greywald, an artist's collective, who have already created some mesmerising artworks in London, Bangkok and St. Petersburg, no less. Keys attached to street furniture will miraculously trigger lights, projected images and sound. Not the sort of thing you would normally expect in Bath, but well worth a visit, and that's on Wednesday the 25th of January to Saturday the 28th of January, and you can check it out on the website illuminatebath.com. And just to remind you, Greywald is the name of the artist's collective. Back in Bristol at the RWA at the top of Park Street, a new exhibition opens up from the 20th of January to the 4th of March by Bristol-based street artist Filthy Luca, known for his colourful, witty and often inflatable sculptures. So you may have seen him around. He takes up residency at the RWA and has created some pieces for the newly cleared back garden area. On the 21st of January on the big screen at Bristol Cathedral at 7:30pm, the film premiere of Severn, as in the river, and Somme, a drama documentary about the life of First World War poet and composer Ivor Gurney. Born in Gloucester, the film was shot on location in Bristol, Gloucester Cathedral and the banks of the River Severn. We're going to play a little clip from the film now. It's the opening scene from the film, where Gurney is incarcerated in Dartford Mental Asylum and where he spent 15 years of his life before his death in 1937.
Hello, Ivor. Please take these flowers. They're for you.
You are Helen, Edward's wife. And Edward is dead.
Yes. Let's talk of him.
Please, take a seat. That's a very pretty hat.
Thank you, Ivor. It was the last present that Edward ever bought for me.
Edward, no longer with us. Do you remember around the fire at Ivy Cottage? Eleanor? Arthur? Wilfred? Robert? Robert and John? Ah! Ah, when we were all free men! Not in chains like we are now! Ah! Ah! Edward! It was the wireless that killed Edward! Forget to get me through the wireless!
This is for you, Ivor. I thought you would like it. It's one of Edward's old Ordnance Survey maps of Gloucestershire.
Longney. Elmore. Hatherley, Upper Hatherley, quickly, quickly,
The orchestra of the Bristol Classical Players will perform three pieces written by Gurney in the trenches, but never performed in public together before. These are the Coronation March, the War Elegy, and the Gloucestershire Rhapsody. Joan Rees, now 88, Gurney's cousin and living in Bristol, will give the address. Tickets £20, £15 reserved. £12 and £8 from Providence Music, 1 St George's Road, Bristol, BS1 5UL. And if you want to telephone them, you can call 0117 927 6536. You can also email if you want to buy a ticket, sales@providencemusic.co.uk. Or you can email Anthea Page, who's helped organise it, anthea.page@hotmail.com. Or you can also give her a call on 0754 353 9415. That's all for the arts section of the Watson Guide. So we will now move on to the music, courtesy of Jeff Sparks. Hello, says Jeff. This is your Watson Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday the 13th of January, Bill Smarm and the Business will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. Also on the 13th of January, Peter and the Test Tube Babies will be performing one of Rachmaninoff's most technically difficult piano pieces with support from Blato Idea and also Criminal Minds at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and Jeff presents Robert Johnson. He was born in Mississippi around 1911 and recorded his material between 1936 and 1937. He died in 1938, aged just 27. It wasn't until his death that he did truly get success and recognition, and has now been classed as a master of the blues and an influence on many musicians and also genres like rock and roll. Here for your listening pleasure is If I Had a Possession Over Judgment Day. Robert Johnson with If I Had Possession Over Judgment Day. For more information, you can check out robertjohnsonbluesfoundation.org. Into Saturday, 14th of January, the Small Fakers, who are a tribute to the Small Faces, will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8 p.m, the tickets are £6 in advance. And finally, on Sunday, the 15th of January, singer-songwriter Cindy Stratton will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. That's all from me. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye. That's all from Dialect this week. Features by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Malcolm Grieve read the first half of Chapter 30 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And we had a What's On Music Guide by Jeff Sparks. I've been John Peters Coleman and the engineer was Michael Noyce. And the producer was Anthea Page indeed. So until next week, goodbye.